Hello, Gallatin Valley. You're listening to KGVM in Bozeman, 95.9. My name is Siobhan O'Steele, and this is Body Politic. On the last episode of Body Politic, we touched on some of the anti-transgender bills making their way through the current Montana legislature. And since there is so much happening, and it's happening so fast and with so much dehumanizing, vilifying misinformation being spread, and this is all being done in under the guise of child welfare, I wanted to bring an actual expert on child welfare onto the show to help sort through the harmful rhetoric that is currently being spread and to better inform the voting public on what's really going on. So in the virtual studio, I have Lauren Wilson, MD. She is president of the Montana chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and she has been a tremendous asset up at the Capitol as far as fighting against these harmful bills like Senate Bill 99, which is what we're going to be mainly talking about today. So I just wanted to ask you, Lauren, what is your specialty, and you know, how are you involved with transgender youth, and how did you come to advocate for them?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So first off, I am a pediatric hospitalist, and a lot of people aren't sure what that means. I'm a pediatrician. So I am board certified in pediatrics, but I practice mostly in a hospital. So when people need to be hospitalized in our pediatric intensive care unit or on the pediatric floor, I'm the person who takes care of them. And I completed additional board certification in the area of pediatric hospital medicine to do that. So about advocating, my other role is there's an organization of pediatricians in Montana. Right now we have 165 members who provide care for kids. And we are the Montana chapter of a larger national organization, which is the American Academy of Pediatrics, which represents 67,000 pediatricians and is the main pediatric professional organization in the U.S. And our chapter advocates for child health in a lot of different ways. We help pediatricians get additional training and resources. We also speak up directly in advocacy when we see things that will impact the health of kids in our state. And that's how I came to be interested in this issue, because we were seeing the legislature start to occupy itself with the issue. And so we felt we had to speak up and provide information.
And thank you for doing that. So unfortunately, this is your second appearance on the show. I hate to have to bring you on under these conditions.
I'd love to not do it as well, but
right.
Legislature does.
So, and really, I mean, things have kind of seemed to backslide since the last legislative session 2 years ago, when we had House Bill 113, which kind of died and then was resurrected as House Bill 427. And you spoke against those bills as well. I was wondering if you could tell me how this current bill, Senate Bill 99, is similar, and what are the things that might make it better or worse?
Sure, I'm happy to. Senate Bill 99 is a bill that the legislature introduced pretty early in the session, and its main goal is to prevent anyone under the age of 18 from making decisions about healthcare as it relates to being transgender, pursuing any sort of gender affirming care, and in some cases even prohibits counseling with state employees and on state property. The difference between this bill and the one that we saw last session is the mechanism for enforcement and also some of the unintentional consequences, or perhaps intentional consequences. I can't speak for their intent. So this bill, instead of fining and criminalizing doctors, actually says that our board of medical examiners, or our professional license, would have to be removed for at least a year for prescribing gender-affirming medications like blockers or hormones to children for the purposes of transition. It allows us to prescribe those medications for other purposes. It also makes a lot of changes to medical malpractice in Montana, which has time limitations that are usually 2 years, but can be up to five, depending on the circumstances of a case. And it changes those time limitations to say that physicians can be sued for this sort of treatment for 25 years after someone turns 18. So potentially, three plus decades of liability for care. And it also adds something to medical malpractice that doesn't exist in Montana in other ways, and that's punitive damages. So it gets around, kind of runs roughshod over medical liability laws in Montana. And the thing that I think is unfortunate, and interesting about this law is they also prohibit the use of public funds for any institution that provides or subsidizes gender-affirming treatments. And so what that means is public funds such as Medicaid, health insurance, can't be used to pay for care at institutions that might provide this care or have providers on their staff who provide this care, which really affects the large majority of institutions in Montana and also outside of Montana. There are things that we can't do in Montana as medical professionals just because we have a population of 1 million people. So if someone needs very specialized cancer care, or if they need an organ transplant, they go out of state. And so I send patients for some of these really advanced procedures out to Seattle or Denver. And what this bill says is we couldn't pay for that care. So if someone were to need specialized care, need really intensive ICU care, those things couldn't be paid by Medicaid because those institutions offer or subsidize gender-affirming care.
Oh, wow, so that's that covers a lot, actually. It's surprising that there isn't more reporting on that just issue of it alone.
Absolutely.
Now, when you're up at the legislature, I know that you and some other medical professionals have testified as to how the different, national medical and psychological associations and even the state and regional ones feel about this bill. Could you tell me pretty much what the consensus is on that?
Sure. And every major national organization or medical society for the different specialties involved with gender-affirming care says that this care is important and that it's beneficial and provides guidelines for how to offer care in a way that is evidence-based and responsible and gives parents and patients decisions and the ability to make informed decisions about what they're doing with their care. So the Endocrine Society, for example, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatry Society, psychologists, all of them have guidelines that say that they generally support this care, and they have best practices for how they expect their members to provide it.
So the proponents of this bill and their out-of-state, often paid so-called experts have woven a lot of mythology around healthcare for transgender youth. And I'd like to go through some of this folklore. So
Sure.
let's start with the process. They like to paint an image that is, if some kid just looks sideways at a doll or a toy truck, some overworked woke parent is instantly going to whisk them away to an activist doctor who will then pass out HRT like Tic Tacs and start gleefully sawing the parts off of kids while counting the scads of cash they're making. Now, we know that's not true, but that's pretty much what they're trying to say. That's the image they're trying to paint in the minds of the public conscience. So, could you tell us, as a doctor who, works with people that are trans, is what is the real process? What are the real steps involved with such a life-altering decision?
Yeah, it's hard to know where to begin with some of the things that I hear. First off, we live in a state where access to healthcare is often problematic and not easy, and that's any healthcare, much less gender-affirming care. The vast majority of people in the state, even if they want this care, might have difficulty accessing it. So I guess to take you through how this normally looks, children develop their gender identity fairly early on. They're able to say, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, at age 3 or 4. And some children start expressing as early as that they are the other gender, not that they want to play with dolls if they're a boy, or that they are tomboy if they're a girl, but that they are the other gender. Not that they wish they were, but that they are, and they insist on that. And some people kind of feel that earlier and then, don't have the words for it or come out with that later. But what they have in common is this insistence that they are the gender that they're, that they feel inside that they are, regardless of what they were assigned at birth. And that, they are harmed by not being able to express themselves that way. And what I hear in stories from parents is, that their child has said, I am a boy. That is who I am. And that when they're not able to express themselves in the way that's concordant with that identity, that they can be very sad, they can be depressed, they can have difficulties. And most parents don't accept right away when they hear that because you're not expecting to hear that from your child. It's usually kind of a years long process of figuring out, what is it that's exactly going on here, and how persistent is this identity going to be, and how do I feel about allowing this person to experiment with their haircut, with their clothes, with their name, in order to find, who they really are. So it's not something that happens from one day to the next. I have a lot of parents who hear things like this from their children and, kind of try to ignore it or try to see if it'll go away. And, I've heard parents say, like, for years, I, told my daughter that she couldn't wear dresses, that she couldn't have long hair, that she couldn't go to school wearing the things that she was wearing. And my daughter was depressed and my daughter didn't smile. And when I allowed her to go out in a dress, she was a different person. And that kind of marked change that happens when people allow kids to express themselves the way they want to, is a pattern that I hear a lot. And I've yet to meet a parent that did that immediately upon hearing from their child, what their child thought about, how they felt inside. And it's important to say that, there is no medical therapy for young children. So there's no medication that's given before the onset of puberty. And so what we recommend for parents is just to listen to their kids. Often families will have therapy, kids will have therapy, in order to let them process and figure it out, because there's just a lot of stigma associated with different gender expressions in our society. And it kind of helps for people to have assistance in sorting that out.
It's another part of the folklore I think you hear a lot. People that are critical of transgender kids always saying, well, when my kid was this age, they thought they were a cat for a couple weeks or whatever. I mean, can you explain why this is vastly different?
Yeah, it's funny. Developmentally, kids have all sorts of stages where they'll have imaginary friends, or, my own kids have been cats and wanted to be fed under the table and all of those things. And those are totally normal things that young kids will do. And they want to pretend that they are doing something else. But, when you talk about their identity and what gender they identify as, that's a very different thing than pretend play. And it's not something that we would confuse as clinicians. It's not something that we would worry about in a young child. So gender identity is something that, persists over time, and children are insistent that's who they are, and they're consistent in saying that's, that is how I feel over, at least 6 months, for diagnostic criteria, but in most cases, years.
So, as a transgender adult, I find that whole line of questioning kind of dehumanizing to children, as if, they can't know their own mind at all. I remember what I felt like at that age, and I guess the criticism is that children can't know anything about their own gender at that age, that it's going to necessarily change. And no matter what I tried, I couldn't change that. And I ended up living a life that was probably not ideal for me. It certainly was a sad life. And I think a lot of it could have been salvaged had I had access to the proper care from a young age. And I think a lot of trans adults can attest to that. So they talk about, when parents have a kid that might be gender nonconforming, how they might just, rush to judgment or even maybe push their kids towards a gender. I mean, have you ever encountered anything like that?
No, I cannot imagine in a society where where transgender and non-binary and two-spirit people are stigmatized to the extent that they already are, that someone would be pushing their child into that. I have yet to see that happen.
Yeah. It's interesting that they also so often say, well, a children cannot be trusted with a life decision this big at such a young age. But the reality is that sometimes children at these ages are choosing to end their life, which I think is a little bit more life altering than just, deciding to change your name and ask people to call you a different pronoun.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that argument really bothers me too, because there's a couple pieces of it. Children are choosing how to express themselves, and we allow them the freedom to express themselves as part of their development. Children are not consenting to medical care. Children cannot consent to this medical care. The age of consent is 18, and so we work with parents who know their child best and are living this with their child in order to make decisions around medical therapies, and what to do as a result. What a child is responsible for is, expressing themselves, and that's what we hope for all children, whether they're cis or trans or whatever's going on with them.
Yeah, so another part of the folklore that is out there is it seems like, and I heard this at the last testimony I was at, that they were inferring that somehow kids were being fed gender ideology at school, that some children are being told, well, wouldn't you be happier as another gender by perhaps teachers or school counselors, which seems to me if that was really happening, that would be some kind of professional. Misdeed. Is there, I mean, have you ever heard of anything like that happening? I mean, that wouldn't that be against, a counselor's code to do such a thing?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously can't be in every office and know what's said, but that doesn't really even pass the sniff test for me as something that someone would do. I think what's getting confused are expressions of tolerance at school, that we should accept people for who they are, with, someone pushing someone to a different identity, which just frankly doesn't make sense and is not something that I have ever heard of or seen happening. I think tolerance is a really important thing for our schools to be teaching for so many reasons. Tolerance of people who are different skin colors, different gender identities, that reduces bullying among all kids. They've done research on that, actually. If you have a gay straight alliance at your school, not only are people less likely to bully LGBTQ children, but they're less likely to bully each other in general. So I think there are people for whom that tolerance feels threatening. And it feels like pushing, when it's in fact something that we know really just helps kids to thrive.
Have you heard of the term gender trending?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like there's one of the other criticisms is that since there's been an increase in the number of trans kids, starting transition, that it's somehow some kind of a social ill, that something people are thinking, well, everyone else is doing it, why don't I do it? Aren't there safeguards in, the current model of transgender healthcare that safeguard against such things? And if there are, what are they?
Yeah, so when a transgender child is being treated by a physician, by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, these are things that must be done slowly over time. So if you see someone initially and the parents suspect that their child is transgender or is gender diverse, then that's something that is the start of a conversation. But it's not, no one is leaping into any medical decisions here. We really want to know that a child is insistent, persistent, and consistent in this identity before we have any sort of medical intervention at all. And the other piece of that is that medical intervention is not the same for everybody. There's no one path or a cookie cutter sort of way to do this care. Some people do want medical therapy, like medications. Some people, eventually end up having surgeries, but a lot of people also don't. They express themselves in different ways, and they, don't need any treatment from a medical professional at all. So I think the important thing is to be thoughtful. The important thing is to take time to make sure that people are, really consistent, persistent, and insistent, as I've said before, and that they understand the risks and benefits to medical treatment. And that's really no different than anything that we do medically. We want to make sure that people understand that there are risks to anything we do, and what the benefits might be and what they might not be. But I start all sorts of medications for people and have these discussions every day, and it's nothing different that we do with someone who might be gender diverse.
So speaking of that, a lot of talk has been around the so-called puberty blocking drugs, and there's a lot of mythology now about how very, very dangerous these drugs are. Could you talk a little bit about what these drugs were originally conceived for, and how they're used with transgender youth?
Sure. So puberty blockers are GnRH analogs, so gonadotropin-releasing hormone analogs, things like Lupron, and they're medications that we've used for about 4 decades for different indications. They're used for adults in prostate cancer. We've used them in kids for precocious puberty. So sometimes a kid will develop secondary sexual characteristics or start going through puberty at a very young age, say 4 or 5. And that's obviously pretty socially damaging for them, not to mention can impact their final adult height. And so we, in that case, would prescribe a puberty blocker, like Lupron, and they would receive that until they were ready to go through puberty, at a typical age. So that's what we use for them for. They've been used for trans people for some time as well, and they have known side effects. One of the bigger ones is just not being able to build bone density while you're on them. And so that's something that we definitely would discuss in detail with a patient who's taking a medication like that. The things that we do for that is, calcium and vitamin D supplementation. Weight-bearing exercise is really important for bone density. And puberty blocker treatment is not forever. So when you're off the medication, then you really need to pay attention to building bone density there too. But it's an effect, but it's also, there are medications that I use for asthma. For example, I use systemic steroids sometimes if someone has severe asthma, and those medications have a whole lengthy list of side effects that we talk about as well. And in my mind, this is not, again, any different than care for any other medical need.
So one of the things about puberty blockers that our side says is that as soon as you suspend using them, puberty will resume.
Correct.
And
Yeah.
in the case of a trans child, if they want to continue with their transition, then that puberty would be altered by HRT. Is that correct?
Correct. So, what I've been hearing this year that I didn't hear 2 years ago is there is a piece of misinformation out there that puberty blockers are not reversible, which I don't even really know where that comes from, but puberty blockers are reversible. If you stop them, then puberty will resume. And that's how we use them for people who have early or precocious puberty as well. You stay on it until you need to be, as long as you need to be. And then you stop, and then you can go through puberty in your natal sex. And so what that means for us is, for trans children is that they remain on blockers and kind of make a decision, or can make a decision to stop therapy at any point, and then eventually might make a decision to go on to hormones if they want to pursue further medical intervention. And then the puberty blockers have meant that you haven't gone through some of the effects of puberty in your natal, in your sex at birth that would be disturbing or distressing for you and would be irreversible. So puberty blockers kind of prevent some of those irreversible changes that a patient might not want or might be difficult for them.
And that aspect of it, of course, would be very important to a trans child, especially if they're intent on continuing with their transition. So, and that's another thing, another probably one of the biggest folklores is the myth of desistance in, trans youth patients. Can you tell us about that desistance myth, and I don't know if you're familiar with that study. What are some of the flaws in that study? Why we shouldn't really believe the persistence myth or the desistance myth, I'm sorry.
Sure. So desistance or detransition is something that's been brought up increasingly as well, and it's largely used to say that this care is a bad idea and to prevent care for all transgender youth. There are people out there with all sorts of statistics. I've heard every number under the sun in some of these hearings about this. The most common thing people bring up is there's an older study that looks at detransition and says that up to 80% of people will detransition. That's the one that I hear a lot of people quoting. And it's really been debunked pretty thoroughly as far as, the definition that they're using. So looking at that study, they first, you have to know what your denominator is in the study. And they took a bunch of children who, if you were to use criteria for gender dysphoria and for being trans that we use today, they would not meet criteria for that. So those would not be people that would be offered medical therapy under any circumstances. That particular study also had a lot of patients that they couldn't follow up with. I think 43% of them they could not get in contact with after the study, and then they just made the assumption that they had detransitions, which is not something that is that we should be doing in medical studies. If we can't follow up on patients, we call that loss to follow up. If we have a high rate of that, then we don't interpret that as they all had the same outcome. So that study is not. Is by far, not the best out there to be quoting. And there are much higher quality studies that have looked at this more recently, and found that the rate of detransition or desistance is definitely in the single digits. There's been a large study that looked at, I think it was 11,000 folks, but I have to look it back up again. It found about 2.5% detransitions at some point. And there are other studies looking at reasons for detransition and looking at, numbers who detransitioned and the reasons for it. So they found that, kind of, 8% or so in the study would detransition, but most of the time it was just temporary. And for those who detransitioned, some of them were in fact non-binary rather than trans. And some the most common reasons for detransitioning were external pressures. So, family pressures, financial pressures, stigma at work, those sorts of things, rather than truly feeling that their identity had changed. So, I think it's really important to look at this accurately. And I would never diminish or question someone's experience if they say they regret their transition, but to use, a rare example of regret to deny people care for something that has been, in my mind, amply proven to improve their lives is, I think, a misuse of that statistic and something that we should be looking at with skepticism.
I couldn't agree more. Dr. Wilson, it's looking like we're just about out of time for this first half of our show, and I did have a lot of other questions I really wanted to get your take on. So I'm going to ask you to come back for the second half of the show, and to our audience, I hope that you will tune back in a few minutes, and we will continue our conversation with Dr. Lauren Wilson, MD. This is KGVM Bozeman, and you are listening to Body Politic.